Midday Report on 702, your number one news and talk station.
It's just gone 9 minutes past 12 o'clock. Good afternoon from me, Ray White, on the Midday Report. Great to be with you on this Monday. Coming up on the show in the next hour, supporters of the Zuma Must Go campaign have gathered at the Union Buildings in Pretoria, demanding that the president go. Then three policemen have told about how miners were killed execution style at Marikana in 2012. So taking a closer look at what they've had to say. Then the trial of triple axe murder accused Henry von Bredaar is wrapping up in the High Court in Cape Town, and the Mo Ibrahim Prize has been awarded to former Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. Other stories on the show this afternoon, lots to talk about. As always, I do like to talk to you. You can SMS me on 31702 or 31567, or just tweet on @RayWhiteSA.
The Midday Report on 702.
Your number one news and talk station.
And it is the big story, I think, of the month. It's now been over a week since the ANC's top six first met to discuss the possible exit of President Jacob Zuma. So what has happened over the past week? And has President Zuma's exit been bungled? Well, or is it just a case of a leader simply not wanting to exit, despite the goodwill of those negotiating with him? The ANC had planned an NEC meeting. That was last week, but this was cancelled to make way for constructive talks. Was this a mistake? There is an ANC-NEC meeting scheduled to start at about 2 o'clock this afternoon. On the line is political analyst Rolf Matecha. Good afternoon, Rolf. Welcome to the Midday Report. Now, was it a mistake to have talks instead of the ANC just going for the jugular and saying it's time to go?
Good afternoon, Ray. I think that what happened with the talks is that they have actually raised expectations that the ANC will be able to internally manage this. When those expectations are not met, because up to this far, we don't have a sense as to what are the concrete agreements that have been made during the talks. And now that we hear that the ANC is having its NEC, which they decided to cancel out of the idea that maybe they could gain something by just the talks. I do think that where we are, it appears the talks have not been fruitful. And what worries me is the expectations that have been set on this. It's about the ANC being honest. So if the ANC cannot handle this, or they are having a difficulty in handling this, I think they should be honest and forthright with the nation instead of sending mixed messages as if they are handling it, but yet you don't get a concrete sense as to what's happening.
It's interesting that you say that. Just listening to ANC leader Cyril Ramaphosa yesterday, saying the NEC would decide today, South Africa will have clarity today. Can he really say that? I mean, does he really know?
You know, that is exactly one of the things, one of those mixed messages, because even when they say the NEC will decide, for me, it is an acknowledgement that the talks have actually not been able to do that. And also, it says that there will be that agreement which will result in the president actually having to leave office. That is the impression that is coming out. My view is that, Ray, if members of ANC, the top six and other senior leaders could not agree up to this point, what makes it so different that the NEC will just speedily expedite this and agree? There is likely to be some form of deadlocks or even extended talks within the NEC to deal with this.
You're actually quite right. Just thinking about what you've said, is there enough support within the ANC's NEC to recall Zuma? Maybe he's turned around and thought, you know what, I'll take my chances.
You know, there might not be, because President Jacob Zuma, he might be seen as a dishonest leader. Whatever evidence it is out there, everybody can make up their mind. But one thing about him is that President Jacob Zuma understands the internal functioning of the ANC. And certainly it means he read the NEC very well. And if he could not concede to those bilateral talks with Ramaphosa, he knows that perhaps he can try it out with the NEC. And Ray, perhaps he even knows he can go to Parliament and survive a motion. I mean, it is not unthinkable, because he keeps on saying the people love him. And if the broader nation doesn't love him, probably there is still a significant number of people within the ANC who love him.
Interesting you say that. If the NEC, though, recalls Zuma today, this could be a giant mistake on his part, because he loses and he could have gained other things, thinking about legal fees and other things that he had demanded.
Exactly. He would have gained a lot had he conceded. And I think by just gauging the balance of forces, gauging the mood and the wind, how it's flowing within the ANC, probably he decided that, you know what, I'm not going to concede to anything. Take this thing to the NEC. Probably he knows, he's got a sense that within the NEC there is no unity. And Mr. Ramaphosa actually came forth and accepted that at least there is disunity and there is no unity. But he still didn't answer as to whether the talks are deadlocked because members could not agree whether or not President Jacob Zuma have to go.
Interesting. A reminder on Facebook. 3 years ago today is the day that the EFF were asking Jacob Zuma to pay back the money. 3 years later and we're still sitting here.
That's the situation. For me, Ray, what worries me a lot is that we can talk about the technicalities of the talk. We can talk about how Mr. Ramaphosa need to be firm and so forth. But the truth of the matter is that within the ANC, there are still people who believe President Jacob Zuma should stay. Those are the people who still exist within the ANC, and they do have their reasons. That is the main issue here, that even when he is gone, it is still going to take a great deal of work to actually disentangle some of the web that of patronage that we have characterized his leadership.
Ralph, you got feelers out there. What are you expecting from this afternoon's NEC meeting?
I would be surprised if it even finished on time. I would be surprised if there is an announcement at 5 o'clock, Ray. This issue has been going around within the ANC for a while, and maybe they need to sit there for 4 days or 3 days. I don't know, but I don't think they will be able to quickly get this thing done within such a short space of time. I would be surprised what urgency will they be responding to now. Maybe the possibility that the opposition parties will stage a motion of no confidence and the entire cabinet will have to go. Maybe that is urgent enough. But looking at the attitude and the manner in which ANC members speak about each other in the public, conflicting each other, it's going to be difficult for them to get this done within a specified time period.
Political analyst Ralph Matecha, I really do appreciate you coming on to the Madeira Report this afternoon. Well, a group calling themselves supporters of the Zuma Must Go campaign have gathered at the Union Buildings in Pretoria, demanding, of course, that the president go. However, the march has been given the thumbs down by the Gauteng ANC and also the SACP. On the line is convener of the Zuma Must Go march, Hangwe Maumele. Good afternoon, Hangwe. Welcome to the Madeira Report. Now, have you received widespread support for today's march then?
Some of our supporters were threatened. You would recall in the morning we issued out a statement to say there was a bagi and a kumbi, and in that bagi there were more than 30 people that has firearms, and then there was a chaos that happened. Some of our supporters were beaten, and then in the township some of our transport were then stopped there. So we had a some of the challenge of those things. And then I was called on the side by some 6 NEC members to engage with me to say, please, they pleaded with me to say, no, I'll postpone the meeting, wait until we announce. If we are not successful on the attempt, then you guys can continue from tomorrow. So we then take that advice from the elders to say, if they are saying that we should wait a bit, they have seen the great concern that we have. And then what we have then said to them, we said, okay, we are not cancelling anything. We'll just sit around and see what is going to happen.
Hangwe, why do you think this is happening, that you have been given the thumbs down? Because there seems to be quite a bit of support within the ANC for Zuma to go. Oh, we seem to have lost him. That's Hangwe Maumele. He's the convener of the Zuma Must Go March. It's 17 minutes past 12 o'clock.
The Midday Report on your number one news and talk station.
Some of your tweets and your SMSs at Ray White SA. Zaki Matabula says, it's taking long to get breaking news. We're waiting for, but to me, the elephant is big for ANC to get out now, says Zaki, saying, implying that President Jacob Zuma is not going to go. Then David Klompas says, Zuma out of his depth, in my view. Yes, he is a shrewd player of ANC politics. I think that his comrades are scared because when Zuma falls, then they will fall as well. And then another one, Brian Bucker says, we shouldn't be surprised. The gangster president was simply employing his usual Stalingrad strategy. Then some of your SMSs as well. One says, Ray, Banker Baroda is state-owned. Does this not imply any Indian government in or implicate Indian government in state capture should this not, says Karabo. I'll have some more on the Bank of Baroda pulling out of the country shortly. But keep your tweets coming on at Ray White SA and your SMSs 31702 or 31567. An Eyewitness News exclusive story from the weekend. Imminent plans to arrest IPED head Robert McBride and also several investigators. McBride suspects a team of detectives from the Northwest are planning to arrest him and several of his senior officials. McBride believes several recent high-profile arrests has prompted efforts to neutralize the watchdog body. On the line is the person who broke the story at the weekend, Eyewitness News reporter Barry Bapin. Good afternoon, Barry. So what exactly did you find them?
Good afternoon, Ray. Well, it's the concerns that have been raised by Robert McBride. Now, the investigation itself is nothing new. There were attempts last year by IPED to try and interdict this particular team of investigators from the Northwest Province from investigating IPED investigators, because there's a conflict of interest here. This team of Northwest investigators are themselves the subject of investigation by IPED. And so they're basically conducting, or they're allegedly conducting, this counter-investigation against IPED. But there exists this conflict of interest. Now, the matter is still pending in court, so that interdict was not obtained, but McBride saying he did raise this concern with police management, that there was this team investigating his own investigators. And he's saying that it is the result of, firstly, he says the team was appointed by Khomotso Bokshane when he became the subject of an investigation. But now, of course, we've seen several other high-profile arrests in the last couple of weeks. Of course, Bokshane appeared in court last week. We had Morris Chabalala, so-called Captain KGB from Crime Intelligence the previous week, and before that it was the acting head of Crime Intelligence in the Free State. She appeared in court on charge of defeating the ends of justice. She was allegedly trying to help Bokshane. So what McBride's saying is that these series of investigations has now really put the pressure on this particular team to act against IPED, and he's warning, he's putting it out in the public that there is this effort to undermine the police watchdog body.
Well, it's a great tactic to put it out into the public because now we all know about it, but what has been the response from police management then?
Well, what the police is saying is that they're not aware of any plans for the imminent arrest of Robert McBride or any of the IPED investigators. But then, of course, we had Police Minister Fikile Mbalula in Rustenburg yesterday saying that IPED has his full support. And if there is anything to come of this, it would be handled professionally and properly through the correct channel. So the police saying there's nothing on the boiler or nothing going to be happening soon. And, of course, the political principal saying that IPED still has his full support.
Now, hearing you say this, but you have documents to back this up. So even if police management do deny this, you've still got the documentation.
Well, indeed. There is indeed a charge sheet that has been drafted. The charge sheet that I've managed to have sight of was drafted against one of the IPED investigators. And the charge that they're formulating against them is they're accusing them of unlawfully providing information, IPED information, to non-members of IPED. Those non-members of IPED happen to be Paul O'Sullivan, forensic investigator, his attorney, Sarah Jane Trent. But you remember that Sullivan is the complainant in the Bokshane matter. So here it comes full circle about the people being implicated here. So what this team is alleging is that information was unlawfully given to Paul O'Sullivan and his attorney. But as we understand it, the information did relate to the very case that O'Sullivan is a complainant in.
Eyewitness News reporter Barry Bapin on the line from Pretoria.
702 and Cape Talk.
The Midday Report.
In the city press at the weekend, a constable from the police's K-9 unit and two of his fellow officers told of how at least one of their colleagues and others from the police's special task force shot striking mine workers in Marikana in August 2012. He says the miners had surrendered and were begging for their lives, but they were shot anyway. There have been numerous questions about what happened on that day in Marikana when 34 mine workers were shot dead. On the line is the author of Murder at Small Copy, the real story of the Marikana massacre, Greg Marinovich. Greg, thanks for joining us all the way from Massachusetts in the United States.
Hi, Greg. How are you doing?
Thanks for waking up. Sorry we actually woke you up, but more evidence of what happened on that day. Your thoughts?
Well, really, it's been almost 6 years since the massacre, and we've been waiting for someone in blue to finally come out and speak. And it seems that this guy in Seleng, who's got a labor dispute with SAPS, has finally sharpened his memory and his morality to come out and speak about it, what happened. And it fits with what miners, eyewitnesses who were miners, saw and lived through.
Greg, what did you find, for those who haven't read your book? I mean, you went behind the scenes. You spoke to those involved. What did people say?
Well, I never spoke to cops, so no cops would speak to me. But what happened was that the first shooting that took place that we all saw on our TV sets at so-called Scene 1, had two versions. The cops said that they were acting in self-defense. These guys were charging at them. And the miners said they were just trying to escape being trapped, and that they were led into what they call the gap trap, which kind of the commission seemed to point to that the second version is more correct. But then the other half of the miners who were killed a little while later at Small Copy, which they refer to as Scene 2. And it was there that this City Press article describes what happened. And this is where I had informants who were hiding from the police as the police were coming in there and shooting people who had their hands up begging for their lives to be spared and were being killed nonetheless.
Greg, do you think there will ever
this
be...
I
was just going to say, do you think there'll ever be any closure in this? Because you're about to say, this is what the big... and then finish that sentence.
So this is what the big police cover-up was about, was that they knew they couldn't hide what happened at Scene 1, so they tried to turn and twist that into something else, but they initially pretended there was only one scene, that everyone got killed in that first thing that we saw. And it was pretty easy to spin that one with the footage and the stills that is there. It is easy to manipulate. But what happened at Scene 2, they knew they couldn't manipulate. Though they tried very hard in the commission. They lied to the commission. They had false testimony. They had... it was unbelievable. And that all got turned on its head eventually.
Just hearing you speak about the commission, Greg, do you think that the truth actually came out from what was told?
Not the full truth, because they never interviewed any of the low-down shooters. They just ran out of time, and it was all obfuscation and time-wasting by the upper staff, you know, the commissioners and the generals, most of whom lied. 90% of the cops who went up there lied through their teeth.
Author of Murder at Small Copy, the real story of the Marikana massacre, Greg Marinovich. Thanks for getting out of bed and joining us all the way from Massachusetts in the United States.
The Midday Report. Business.
Coming up to 25 minutes to 1 o'clock, and it's the big story in Eyewitness News. The Bank of Baroda has officially notified the Office of the Registrar of Banks of its intention to exit South Africa. The bank made headlines in the last year for being the last financial institution to still hold Gupta bank accounts. Indian-based company retained Gupta accounts after South Africa's big four banks cut ties with the controversial family. The South African Reserve Bank says it's in discussions with the Bank of Baroda to ensure that its withdrawal from this country is orderly. Now, the news, Taste Holdings CEO Carlo Gonzaga has tendered his resignation effective from tomorrow. Tyrone Moodley will change his function from non-executive director, and he'll be appointed to group CEO. In other news, the Serious Fraud Office has charged Barclays Bank with unlawful financial assistance related to billions of pounds raised from Qatar in 2008. The same charges were brought against Barclays in June last year. The move to charge Barclays Bank is rather significant because it holds the banking license that allows it to operate in different countries. In 2008, to avoid a government bailout, Barclays took a £12 billion loan from Qatar Holdings, which is owned by the state of Qatar. Now, under that deal, Barclays loaned £2.3 billion back to Qatar Holdings. The CFO alleges or says that the loan was used either directly or indirectly to buy shares in Barclays, which the CFO says is unlawful financial assistance, and it wants action to be taken. Looking at the markets now, a short while ago, the All Share was up 0.4% at 56,124 points. Most of the board in positive territory, except the gold miners, down about 1%. Looking at the Rand, it's firmed against the dollar in early trade ahead of a meeting of the ANC's NEC to decide the fate of President Jacob Zuma, who is under mounting pressure to step down. It's now 11.95 to the dollar, 16.59 to the pound, 14.67 to the euro. Gold, $1,321.26. Platinum, $995.74. And Brent crude oil is $63.99. More business news with Bruce this afternoon, and also on The Money Show this evening.
Midday Report.
There's concern about suicide at schools in our country, with calls for prevention and intervention measures to be urgently implemented. This follows research showing that the high rate of suicide mortality in South Africa compared to other selected African countries is at an all-time high. While South Africa's suicide mortality rate is lower than some countries in our continent, suicide is still a major problem. On the line is research analyst at the Institute for Race Relations, Tawanda Makumbe. Good afternoon, Tawanda. Welcome to the Midday Report. Now, what exactly did the research actually reveal?
Afternoon. Our research showed that the suicide mortality rate in South Africa is high compared to other African states, such as Algeria. So first and foremost, South Africa's rate is 10.7 per 100,000 people. Then for Algeria, it's 3.1 per 100,000 people, Libya 5.5 per 100,000 people, and then Ghana has got 6.9 per 100,000 people. So our rate is very high, and we actually figured out that economic hardships and lack of solutions to life problems in South Africa, and also lack of proper suicide prevention measures in school and communities, all those factors contribute to our rate being high.
To wonder, what are the recommendations to address this? I mean, we've always struggled with suicide in this country, but it just seems to have got worse.
Yeah, exactly. So we actually recommend that the government must put in place proper suicide prevention measures, especially in schools and universities in South Africa. And for example, those groups, those groups that can help people. Like if your stress levels are high, if you are depressed, you can go there, they can talk to you. And I think that can help us to reduce our rate.
Looking at schools, though, I mean, do our youngsters get enough counselling, or are they just thrown into a school? They're one of 40 school pupils in a classroom, and they're just a number.
Well, in other cases, they get counselling, but we don't think that there's a proper follow-up after that counselling to see if the counselling is really worked to a student. So you can actually approach a student centre where you can get help. But we don't think that there's enough follow-ups to see that the student has really been helped after that.
Tawanda, why do we have such a high suicide rate? Is it because of just normal day pressures? But how do we compare to other developing countries?
Well, I think the state of our economy, people are having economic hardships, high unemployment rate, people don't have money for fees, and all those factors, they can actually contribute to high depression levels and then suicide. And compared to other developed countries, when we talk about countries such as Australia, Australia's rate is high compared to us, though. It's at 11.8. But when we look at China, China's rate is lower than ours. Israel is lower than ours. Germany is also above ours, though.
Are you going to be speaking then to the Department of Basic Education to say, we've got these findings, let's work together?
Exactly, exactly. That's the next step from here.
Sounds good. Research analyst Tawanda Makumbe at the Institute for Race Relations on the line from Johannesburg.
The Midday Report on 702.
Your number one news and talk station.
17 minutes to 1 o'clock. The trial of triple axe murder accused Henry from Badai is wrapping up in the High Court in Cape Town. Judge Siraj Desai is hearing closing arguments after a two-month-long break. From Badai's parents and his brother were killed at their home in Dzolza, that's in Stellenbosch, in January 2015. Van Badai, who has been in the dock for 63 days, is also accused of attempting to murder his younger sister, Marley. He's pleaded not guilty. On the line is Eyewitness News reporter Monique from O'Clock. Good afternoon, Monique. So what has happened so far in court today then?
Good afternoon, Ray. So far we've heard most of the state's argument has been around the fact that it's highly improbable that intruders managed to gain access to the estate, managed to find number 12 Courtship Street, which is situated in the middle of the complex, and then a family seemingly random attack, and then not steal anything, because as you might remember, the defense has argued that it could have been the work of the so-called Balaclava gang of robbers that were behind a series of robberies in 2015 in the Stellenbosch area. And what the state has argued is it's highly unlikely that if it was a Balaclava gang attack, then surely they should have stolen something, which they didn't. And Prosecutor Galloway also mentioned the fact that the family, they were in their sleepwear, they didn't make an effort to cover themselves in any way, and the fact that none of them tried to call for help or tried to hide or tried to run away are all factors indicating that they knew the assailant, because what Prosecutor Galloway argued is if they didn't know the assailant, they would have made some attempt to either run away. The house was big enough to hide in any one of the rooms. And these were some of the main points that were brought up. Galloway also focused on the defense wounds on Marley van Badai, which he says is indicative of the fact that Marley, being the youngest member and being the smallest member of the van Badai family, she didn't try to run. She tried to face the attacker and tried to fight with the attacker as best she could. But obviously she was basically left for dead. Galloway says that it's clear that the intent of the attacker was also to kill her, just due to the severity of her injuries.
Yeah.
So these were some of the main points.
Has Henry van Badai been out on bail? What has happened over the past 2 months?
Yes, he has been out on bail for the past 2 months. I must say something that's not hard news related. He came into court with completely new look. I don't know if you managed to see any of the pictures that we've been tweeting. His head is completely shaved. And when one of the photographers jokingly asked him what's up with the new look, he said it was in a bid to save water. But he joked about it. He looked quite relaxed when he entered court. He was smiling. But again, during the court proceedings, he sat there with a stoic face, as he's done for the past 60 days. We couldn't get much more out of him, just to ask how he's doing, what's his frame of mind.
Yeah.
But he looked relaxed. He looked ready for court to wrap up.
So, Monique, what happens next then?
So what happens next is Prosecutor Galloway has the whole of today to conclude or wrap up her closing arguments, and then Advocate Peter Buerta has whole of tomorrow to do his, and then on Wednesday, Judge Desai said Galloway then has up until tea to do the rebuttal to Buerta's closing arguments. And then after this, or after Wednesday, hopefully, it's judgment, which will be handed down in March.
Right. Eyewitness News reporter Monique Mortlock on the line from Cape Town.
The Midday Report on your number one news and talk station.
9 minutes to 1 o'clock, and the DA in Gauteng is conducting an oversight visit to the Reja Park Secondary School in Ekurhuleni. Three teachers and the school principal were implicated in a sex scandal. Videos and pictures of the principal with different school pupils in his office went viral on various social media platforms recently. On the line is the DA's shadow MEC for education in Gauteng, Kume Ramolifo. Good afternoon, Kume. Welcome to the show. Why exactly are you at the school today then?
Afternoon, Ray, and to the listeners. Obviously, we're just doing our oversight to check what type of support is being provided to ensure that the Rekha Park School learning and teaching are taking place. Obvious after the incident, which we believe has actually dented the image of the school. But because there are actions which have been taken, we also need to take care of learners and teachers because the business has to continue like other schools.
Are you satisfied, though, that sufficient action has been taken against those involved?
There are gaps which we observed, but we must recognize that the MEC did put some actions or efforts in place. Some of the gaps, obviously, the three teachers who are implicated, I mean, they are all now reporting at the district level. So what has not been done is to replace all of those teachers so that learning and teaching do take place. So they only, substituted two teachers instead of three, which now raises some sort of gaps at the school. When we were at the school, we realized that some of the learners were outside of the classes because they have one teacher short, and the obvious was one teacher who was absent. So that then created another dilemma to say if the staff complement is not complete. So it has an effect in terms of learning and teaching.
Right. Now, this principal, he was due to be arrested. What's the status quo there with him and also other teachers as well?
Ray, the information which we have, from the committee side, we just told that this matter is too technical. And we, from the DA side, we have actually submitted formal questions to just get a clear indication of the status. Because one, we were told that the teacher has actually resigned last year. But then the question is, why, if he resigned last year, why was at the school at the beginning of this year? So we're failing to get just clear indication of where this case is when it comes to the principal. So we feel like we'll use the parliamentary process where we table questions to the MEC to get a clear indication of what is the status of the principal as we speak.
But surely the principal would be arrested, whether he's still employed or not. He's committed a crime, or allegedly he's committed a crime. Surely he needs to be arrested.
Indeed, that should be the case. But the state on the other side must be able to provide witnesses which will be able to testify.
Okay, so you have no further information on that. Okay, Kumi Ramolifo, DA Shadow MEC for Education, on the line from Boksburg.
702 and Cape Talk.
The Midday Report.
The Mo Ibrahim Prize has been awarded to former Liberian leader Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. The prize was not awarded, well, hasn't been awarded since 2014, and has only just been awarded five times. They're very picky about this. On the line is Eyewitness News Africa correspondent Jean-Jacques Cornish. Bonjour, Jean-Jacques. Why now? I mean, 4 years later, this must be very important.
Bonjour. Well, you know, Ray, this prize has been going since 2007. The first recipient was Joaquim Chissano, the then Mozambican president who'd left office. Mo is a telecoms billionaire from Sudan who decided to put something back into Africa in this way, recognizing great issues. Once they had gone out of office democratically, were liable. So the recipients have been an honorary recipient, Nelson Mandela, Festus Mogae of Botswana, 2008, Pedro Verona Pires from Cape Verde in 2011, and of course Namibia's Hifikepunye Pohamba in 2014. So that's five recipients plus the honorary, and that means in 6 years, Mo Ibrahim's looked over Africa and said, nope, there's not anybody worthy enough to win it this year. So it is something really, really exclusive, you could argue. And it's $5 million that goes to the recipient, paid at $200,000 a year, and then over five years, and then $200,000 a year for life after that. So it's something that, a president could live on, or former president could live on quite comfortably.
It's very interesting, though, because her very own party has expelled her.
Yes, indeed. And George Weah, who has succeeded her, it was said that she had supported him and not the candidate from her own party, her former deputy president. She's obviously contesting that, but George Weah is saying that he's been left with an economy in absolute tatters, and it's indeed in handing the prize or awarding the prize, Mo Ibrahim has said that, you know, there's many things left to be desired in Liberia. But Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, Africa's first elected woman president, as you said, she inherited a country that was torn by civil war, and she rebuilt it and united it to the extent that he says, Ibrahim does, that this is now a country on which, or created foundations from which the new Liberia can be built. It's something of some esteem to her, and I think her many fans, and I like to say I number myself among them, will be very pleased with it.
Eyewitness News Africa correspondent Jean-Jacques Cornish on the line from Pretoria. And wrapping up the midday report with some cricket. It was good news at the weekend. The Proteas managed to pull one back. Wearing pink, they beat India, but are still 3-1 down in the series. And joining us in our Johannesburg studio is Eyewitness News reporter, sports reporter, Mark Lewis. Mark, good afternoon. So the Proteas, they got it right this time.
Yeah, well, thank you, Ray. They certainly did. It's about time, some might argue. We haven't been very good in the series, but there's this magical performance that seems to come in when these teams playing pink, and it has now been 6 years in a row now that we have not lost in pink, and we played some pretty good sides. Let me tell you, we've played Sri Lanka and Pakistan, the West Indies, India, England. They've all been there before, and they've all lost to South Africa in pink. There really is something that people seem to enjoy about it. The Bull Ring put on a wonderful display as well. The 1.6 million rand got raised as well for breast cancer. So not only is it a good show from the actual Bull Ring, have the Proteas come out to win the match as well. They've picked up their first win in the series for now. 3-1 down, still plenty to play for. But I think what we shouldn't forget as well, as mentioned, that 1.6 million rand now goes towards breast cancer awareness, which I think is outstanding.
Yeah, that's really great. Now, who are the heroes this time around?
Henrik Claassen, the newcomer to the side, he's been absolutely a breath of fresh air, even his post-match press comments as well. Some very funny moments where one comment in particular, someone asked him about the atmosphere at the Bull Ring, and he said that he was talking to his missus a couple of weeks ago to see if they could organize tickets to go and watch the match. And turns out a few injuries later, he gets called up to the Proteas and helps us win the match. He was named man of the match alongside Andile Pekgukwaya towards the back end of the innings, who's been under a bit of pressure of late, and some have been questioning his inclusion, and he was absolutely outstanding because Claassen was set on the other side. It gave Andile the freedom to just, you know, throw hell for leather, and he went absolutely crazy, hitting some very big sixes late in the game to essentially win the game for SA.
Well, it's good to see, because we've had some injuries, so others coming through, and it's nice to see a little bit of depth for a change.
Yeah, well, Abi de Villiers came back on that ODI, which was very important. He's had a bit of a finger injury and was out for the last three ODI, so he's finally returned. Aiden Markram held on to the captain's armband, which I found rather interesting. I thought Abi was going to take that back, but Quinton Okonkwo will still be out for quite some time. Henrik Claassen looks very confident, so I'm happy with him. And now we're just waiting for Faf du Plessis. So hopefully by the time the Australia series comes around, which is next month, we should all three big guns back in the mix. And with a bit of momentum and hopefully a few more good performances against India, we could then see a really exciting series against Australia.
But we've got two to go.
Still two to go.
I don't want to doom it at all. Okay, no, maybe no, they no. should wear pink again. But your
take
thoughts?
Pink to the World Cup. That is what everyone is saying. Take pink to the World Cup. Great. We can't win the series. Of course, India already 3-1 up now, essentially. But with two good performances, we may well draw the series. So it's two still to play. Hopefully we can keep in this vein and go on and pick up a few more victories.
Go the Proteas. Eyewitness News sports anchor Mark Lewis, thanks for joining us on the Midday Report. And that wraps up our program.